Dr. Alan Leica here, and I'd like to welcome you to How to Live a Fantastic Life Show, where we will be discussing the important aspects of your life. We hope to inspire you to live the best life you can. Get out of your comfort zone and explore the awesome world around you. Break through your barriers. Take inspired action. Use the difficulties in your life to achieve the best version of you. Ladies and gentlemen, today we have a very special guest by the name of Cheryl Crowther.
Crowther, actually.
Okay, let me try that again. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special guest by the name of Cheryl Crowther, and it's about surviving the storm. Now, she has written a very special book called Odyssey of Ashes, a memoir of love, loss, and letting go. And Cheryl describes losing her soulmate suddenly and unexpectedly. The night her beloved husband, John, died, he had decided to go sit in the family room, worried that he'd keep Cheryl awake while he took care of a terrible backache. Shortly after he settled in his chair, Cheryl heard an ungodly set of frightening sounds, one like a roaring wind, and then silence. Now, Cheryl tells her story, and I'm going to let her go from there and tell us more about that. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Yeah, this book grew out of the most terrifying and horrifying dramatic experience of my life, completely unexpected. A sudden death is very shocking. So I would say I was in shock for a good period of time going through life. I actually, 2 weeks after he died, I actually was presenting a workshop. I went through with it. Looking back, I have no idea how I did that, except that I kind of put my head down and I go. That's how I often deal with things that come down the pike at me that I haven't really planned
on. Like professionals we are, we're trained not to let our emotions get into the situation. We're trained to push them under the carpet and not really acknowledge anything, because we're there to help our patients and our clients, and that's what we're there for.
Well, and just as a little sidebar, I think that that's one of the issues when we work in healthcare, whatever form that takes, medicine, psychotherapy, social work. And I have also written a book that talks about humanizing the education and the mentoring of health professionals so that we don't have to sort of steel and brace ourselves so much. So that's an interesting comment. I think for me, it's always helped throughout my life to focus on others, to focus out, and that can transform us in many different ways. But Odyssey of Ashes was not something I immediately thought about writing. It came about because 5 months after John died, I was up at Lake Tahoe hiking with some really good friends. We were all four of us were supposed to be there, and it was three of us. And we're on the trail, and my cell phone rings, and I'm immediately annoyed that I've even, I haven't silenced it. I brought this stupid cell phone. It's a beautiful setting, and I wait till I get back to the car. I get back to the car, open it up, and there's a message from a woman who is at that point the liaison of a wonderful organization called Casting for Recovery. This is an organization that works with breast cancer survivors or women living with breast cancer and teaches them the art of fly fishing as a way to prevent lymphedema in the arm. So I had been very fortunate to have been a part of that group when I had breast cancer. And then my husband, John, who was an avid and masterful fly fisherman, went on to work with them as what they call a river helper, taking women out into the river. So every year they have a raffle. The main prize is a guided fly fishing trip for two people to one of the great rivers of the world. And this year it was Montana. John entered all for 9 years. And when Peg called me, the message I got was that She decided to put his ticket into the hopper, and at the gala, she drew out his name. At which point, she felt overcome, so she gave it to someone else to read, and she was offering me this trip to go to Montana. So I decided after some thought that I would go because one of John's wishes was to have his ashes scattered by a trout river. So I was fulfilling a promise, and at that point I thought, you know, there's something synchronistic here. I think there's a story that wants to be told.
Wow, that is quite the story, how that came about.
Yeah.
How you helped to acknowledge and honor his passion by something that was somewhat serendipitous, winning a lottery ticket.
That, you know, it was, as I put it, you know, the the irony of wanting to have won for so long, and then I guess it's like a posthumous award or something, you know, it's like you think the person isn't there to accept it. Yet it was very meaningful to me. And the trip I took was a remarkable journey. I was on a river with a young river guide who took one look at me and thought, oh boy, you know, this is going to be, I'm going to have to drag this old lady around the river. But unbeknownst to him, I had fly fished with John. You know, honestly, I was never very good, but I had had some help with other fly fishers and trainers. John and I learned pretty early, and there's some scenes in the book where it talks about that, how quickly we learned that he was not the best teacher for me. So I had some lovely teachers, and by the time I'd gotten to Montana, I actually was, I could say I was decent at fishing. So I get in the boat, and I think, oh, we're both, I think, thinking, oh, how's this day going to go? But when I start to cast my line, he begins to realize, oh, you know, she actually can fish. So at that point, our day really began, and he was a quiet, very Western kind of man. He always tried to get our boat away from the other fisher people so that we would get into some good waters, and I actually pulled in some beautiful fish. And in fly fishing, it's about catch and release, which I used as a metaphor throughout the memoir, catching and releasing, because it's a metaphor for life where we catch things in, we attach relationships, our work, ourselves, and then inevitably we release. So throughout, I sprinkled fly fishing metaphors about that kind of way of looking at life too.
Well, that's huge. That's huge. You know, that there's a huge message there, because life often means chasing something and releasing parts of it. Mm-hmm. It's opening one door and closing one behind it. Mm-hmm. And when you close that door behind it, often another door opens if we look for it, and it's there.
You know, I think it's always there, and I agree with you. It's if we look for it and we're open to going through it. And when someone dies or something happens in life that, wait a minute, you know, I didn't put in for this one. I wanted A, I didn't want B. Then there needs to be a way to be fluid. And again, I feel like the metaphor of a river, which also runs through this memoir, that a river just keeps flowing. It's always changing. It's a true statement that you never step into the same river twice, because it's always changing and growing. And so if there's an allowance to just flow down that river, grab onto, you know, stones and branches from time to time and see where it takes you. I mean, easier said than done, right?
Yeah. Well, there's a beautiful movie called A River Runs Through It.
Yes.
Was my first introduction to fly fishing, because they bring up fly fishing in that a lot.
it's their religion, right? And it is a religion. I don't know. Do you fly fish? Is that something you do? Or
unfortunately, I cannot. I have an allergy to fish, which I began as a very young person. So I cannot be close to those things, but I can appreciate other people's love for it. And
their passion. Isn't that interesting?
For it.
That's an unusual allergy. Yeah.
Well, you know, allergies come about for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure why I was blessed with this, but that is one of my afflictions in life.
Oh, interesting. That's very interesting. I don't think I've ever heard that. Yeah. Well, so I mean, the first part of this, the Odyssey, is me being, you know, obviously the incident of his death, the initial aspects of what that is like, the shock, what I call the business of death.
Well, let's go through that a little bit, too, because that is so traumatic and happened in such a traumatic way for you.
Yeah.
I mean, you were sailing along, expecting your life to grow together for a number of years, and all of a sudden, it stopped instantly.
Yeah.
That is a pretty tough thing to get through.
The trauma is so shocking, and you're right. It's like the death certificate for John was less than 5 minutes. And in less than 5 minutes, my life changed forever. I'll always remember, and I have written about him in the book, this wonderful young police officer who came. I mean, the chaos, you know, making the call, the 911 operator who was inanely asking me these questions that made no sense, delaying the process of somebody getting there. A sort of a way in which it was unreal, surreal, like next thing there's the firefighters are rushing through the house. And how did they get there? Did I open the door, you know, and then sending me into the next room while they tried to do the work. And I suddenly just began to shake. And I'll always remember these heavy boots coming down my hall and just thinking, you know, this man should not be here. And then the process of just moving into this shock and grief. And again, this beautiful young policeman who, again, I don't know how he got there. He was suddenly in my home, who stayed with me until my sister-in-law, John's sister, got there. It's the middle of the night. And just was with me in the most beautiful, calming, lovey way. You know, I remember the horrors, and then I also remember the kindnesses that happened along the way. The next day, the day after, a very dear friend of mine insisting that we go to the mortuary together, when I, being myself, oh, no, I can do it, you know. And her saying to me, no, you will not do that. And her coming to the mortuary and us sitting there, both of us having Buddhist practices, and us sitting there and her guiding a meditation with his body, and the kindness of people both I knew and the kindness of strangers, to quote that old line from Tennessee Williams, you know? Yeah.
And you know, when you go through something like this, it's the community around you that supports you. And if there's any meaning to this, this truly makes you realize how wonderful people are around you and how they support you in this. And it helps to build your community around you because that community is your sustaining force. It's your driving force in those days when you cannot sustain yourself.
Beautifully put. And I am beyond fortunate, beyond blessed to have a community around me, some very dear friends who I've known for decades, people that we work together very closely, we know each other inside out, who came and just surrounded me and held me throughout when it was difficult for me to, in a way, find my own way, even though I think I pretended I was. I felt as though there were sort of parallel lives I was living. And I do believe this is common in the first parts of a grieving process, particularly when something has happened suddenly. Although even if there's been a long illness, I believe it's true when they say it's always too soon and it's always a surprise, even though people may have gone through. My father had Parkinson's disease, and that was and Lewy body, a horrible thing to witness and go through. But then when he dies, it seems sudden. But it is a very different feeling from a sudden death. So it's just being able to have people be there and almost like shine the light that okay, there's this life, and I would be about my life. I would go to work, you know, very responsible, take care of business. And I also was living in this underwater world at the same time, which I write about, feeling as though I'm out in the middle of the ocean, sort of floating around with no sense of direction. Yet at the same time, I was very directed. I do believe this is common, and I've talked with people, and it's always when I write, I like to give what I hope are takeaways to people. And I have heard from people both that I know and that I don't know that it was so helpful to hear that how reality shifts into this timeless space.
Yeah. And I also think through this phase, you go through a period of time where there's shame and blame, and you have this difficulty in forgiving yourself. You always think, could I have done more? Could I have done something more? Mm-hmm. Could I really have made a difference in that day? Or maybe I didn't do enough in the times gone by in making that. Maybe there were clues that something was going on and I missed them. You know, those are things that often go through a survivor's head in something like that. And did that happen to you?
It did. I felt as though, and it was kind of a crazy thought, particularly when a cardiologist said to me, there was nothing anybody could have done. But I thought, but that neck pain, that back pain, should I have insisted that he go to the emergency room, even though I knew he would have been furious with me about that? But should I have insisted that he do that? Or what should I have immediately just started jumping on him, pounding his heart the minute he got up? Should I have left and gone to the other room, even though he told me to do so? And I still to this day wonder. It's not overwhelming, but sometimes I hear about people doing CPR and miracle things can happen, or someone survives, and I think, you know, what if? I also recognize this, though, and I work with other people in this area as a way of bargaining, a way of thinking that we have somehow some control. If only this, if I'd done that, I can also see it as a way, that guilt, that shame, as a way to sidestep the existential truth is that there are times when we have no control. In fact, most of the time we have no control. We have choice, but no control over what happens. And that's not so easy to sit with. So I think we sometimes slap guilt and shame in some kind of way of believing that we could have had more control.
I think so. And, you know, the phases people go through often when a loved one died, they go through anger, they go through denial, they go through bargaining, they go through depression. You know, those are standard phases that everybody goes through.
Yes, yes.
And finally, they go through an acceptance phase and probably a second phase where they actually grow as a result of the death if they let them. And that is the most difficult phase to get through, because that phase is there, but there is a growth phase where you actually grow beyond that. And that's what you've done a bit in your book. You have actually grown through it, in which you're reaching out and helping others in a situation like this. And I'm sure that also your clients, your patients hear from you, and you help them better than you ever done, because now you're a different person than before all this transpired.
Yeah, yes. I think that's absolutely true. The journey through Montana and what I went through there, including, again, seeing Northern Lights. It was very magical and mystical. All of that really, you know, is absorbed into me. At this point, we'll be 6 years in this May, which seems impossible. It seems like a day ago sometimes and 10 years ago sometimes. I do think that, you know, when I got really angry, the last time I got really angry with him was when COVID started. And I remember we all in California, we all went in, we all had to be isolated. And I remember I stood in front of his picture. I read him the riot act. I was furious. How could you leave me? You know, you left me alone in this and now I have to do it. And one of my friends joked and said, boy, I'll bet he was glad he wasn't there to hear that. So that's just all to say that even some years, angers can happen. Sorrows can happen. I can feel sorrowful even as I talk with you right now. Now, is it that acute? If we were talking a couple weeks after his death, I would probably be here weeping. Now I feel a sorrow in myself, but I live with it and I move on with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's just the realness of our lives and sorrows and losses and yeah.
And the good thing is you haven't let that stick you in a place where you're constantly going through grief and mm-hmm. constantly living that sorrow every day.
That's right.
That's a very negative set of things to go into and to stay into. We've had some tragedies in our family and people have not totally moved on from it. There's a lot of shame and blame going on with those incidents. And that's not healthy. That's not healthy. You know, really, you have to move on, realize that those things happened and those are now in the past. And you have to rejoice for the good days you had with your husband, John.
Yes.
And all the wonderful times you shared. You know, none of us are given tomorrow. None of us are given anything that what we have right now. So you must take full advantage of every day you have and live it to the fullest, because that tomorrow aspect might never be there.
That's right. In 5 minutes, it could be gone. And I think what you're talking about, and you mentioned it in the stages, whether it be of grief or dying, or is depression. And there's a great difference between grief and depression. The grieving process, I find, and hopefully help other people find their way through by actually feeling it, letting it be, going through all the different rooms and closets and up, you know, rivers and skies of that grief. And knowing, again, it is a river that will keep flowing. But if somebody or any of us get sort of caught, maybe we're holding on to the banks of the river and start to get depressed, then that's, for me, when I notice, I don't tend towards depression in that way. I'm fortunate. Some people do, and that's really, really difficult. So I will always notice and try and help people if they're moving into depression. Then we look at, wait a minute, you know, what's happening? Tell me about how you feel like you may be stopping whatever your life force is and your engagement is. So again, I think it's very important to separate grieving from depression.
Yeah. And I also think it's very important to prevent grieving from getting into depression, because there is a fine line there where a person goes all the way full circle into that depression thing, you know, where every day has no meaning and it has a very black hole. And that is that deep black sphere that is very possible from the grieving aspect that's going on.
Exactly. I mean, that level of depression is so, you're right, it's so black and it's so very serious. And so trying to help people find meaning, and when I say help find meaning, I always like to say to people, meaning doesn't have to be all in capital letters. like meaning. It has to be a big thing. Perhaps it's a ray of sunlight on a beautiful garden, or your child, or something that you like to do in life. Maybe you've cooked a beautiful meal, or friends, so that if you can slowly but surely find ways, things, engagements. I'm big on engaging, being engaged in life, being engaged in yourself. Then you can come back into the world, because that level of depression is a leave-taking of aliveness.
Yeah, I think that's important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Cheryl, this show is called How to Live a Fantastic Life.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask you a difficult question, and mm-hmm. it's going to be, how do you, Cheryl, at the current time, live a fantastic life? And it's okay to say, I'm not. But how are you trying to live a fantastic life?
I'm going to be 71 years old in a couple months. And I do feel like I'm living a fantastic life. I'm writing. I feel like my creative energy is probably at its peak. And I hope to carry that peak for at least another decade, fingers crossed, again, day by day. I have wonderful relationships in my life. I have a great relationship with my son. I'm starting to travel again and move back into the world. I feel like my intention for this year, when I thought about it, is emergence. So my fantastic life has to do with emergence.
Well, that's huge. That's a huge realization, and mm-hmm. that is a very special one. Now I'm going to flip the switch 180 degrees, and we have listeners listening to us. Cheryl, how do you recommend they live a fantastic life?
Be open with yourself. Find ways that you engage with your life that are meaningful. And as I already said, meaningful doesn't have to be all in capital letters. It's something that matters to you. Find what matters to you and let that be honored. Laugh a lot. Enjoy yourself, and also find ways to reflect, because I believe strongly in the balance of lightness and darkness. And once we can celebrate both and be engaged in both in our lives, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I remember the words of a country and western song, the name of the artist. Basically, I can't remember, but he says, we enjoy the laughter and the tears.
Very nice. Yeah.
And you know, it certainly is true that we see both and mm-hmm. we enjoy both. And mm-hmm. if we don't allow ourselves to experience both, mm-hmm. we are not the people that we should be.
Yes.
We are
yes.
not the living humans that we are.
Mm-hmm.
Tears
mm-hmm.
help to understand the laughter. And laughter helps us to understand the tears.
Yes, yes, uh-huh. And yes, and to be a whole person, you know, with all of our flaws and our ups and downs and our bumps and our beauties. One of the best advice I ever got on being a parent, and I think it just is rings true for all of us as human beings. The best advice I ever got was from a friend who said, your most important job as a parent is to know your child. And I would parallel that with our most important job as ourselves is to know ourselves as who we are and engage with who we are as fully as we can.
That's huge. Mm-hmm. Well, Cheryl Crowder, you won't believe this, but our time is almost at an end.
Well, it's been a lot of fun.
No. How can people get in touch with the world of Cheryl Crowder, and how can they get your books?
Okie doke. You can always find me at my website, which is CherylCrowder.com.
Can you spell that, please?
Yes, yeah, it's CherylCrowder, CherylCrowder.com. You can find me on Facebook fairly frequently. You can find me on Twitter not so frequently. So, but the website is the best place to go. You can also find my books on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. Yeah, on those sites. Amazon, you can go there. So I'm pretty accessible. You can just even Google my name, Cheryl, Cheryl Croucher, Krauter, and that'll take you to all the myriad little places that I exist on the web.
Perfect. Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah.
Thank you, Alan. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. You were wonderful and you shared a lot. It's very difficult to open yourself up like you did today, but I'm sure it's going to help so many others. It's unbelievable.
Thank you so much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've spent the last half hour with a very special guest, Cheryl Croucher. I encourage you to check out more about her. And if you do need a coach, please check me out. As you noticed, even when I was talking to Cheryl here, I was giving her little guidelines to help her along the way. Because when a person goes through a devastating things like this, they never truly 100% recover. There are little guideposts that flip them back into that pattern without reason, without knowledge. And it's good to have little ways to get beyond that. So check me out, Dr. Alan Lyka, DrAllen Lyka, LYCKA.com. I look forward to hearing you soon. And check back here often because we're going to have a lot of interesting guests. Bye for now.
You've been listening to How to Live a Fantastic Life. Be sure and pick up a copy of Dr. Lyka's book, The Secrets to Living a Fantastic Life, on Amazon.com. And you'll want to subscribe right here on this page so you don't miss a single episode. Have a fantastic day.